Thank you, Joseph, and good morning, everyone. First of all, before we get started, I'd like to give a shout out to my colleagues in the 10th District who are watching us this morning from our office in Kansas City as well as our branch in Denver. So hello to my colleagues as well as the community partners that we've invited to watch this morning. We are in for a treat. We have a wonderful panel in store for you this morning about overcoming local challenges. The tide of foreclosure sweeping the nation is leaving behind thousands of vacant homes and blighted neighborhoods. Homeowners watch in shock as the values of their homes plummet far below the cost of their mortgages. Unable or unwilling to pay rising monthly payments, many have succumbed to foreclosures or have simply abandoned their homes to the bank. As a result, the number of vacant homes have spiked in recent years. Foreclosed and vacant homes can sit unsold and empty for months or even years, as Sandy mentioned this morning, falling into disrepair, attracting crime, and bringing down the values of adjacent homes, thus spreading the blight throughout entire communities. Consumers not only lose their homes, they lose their wealth and a piece of the American dream. The loss of tax revenues to communities translates into less money for schools, firefighters, police officers, street repairs, and social services. Communities are also saddled with new costs of upkeep and demolition, or must spend money to hunt down absentee property owners to get them to mow the weeds or secure their increasingly dangerous buildings. Community development plans are often put on hold. Financial institutions that sold or serviced the loans can find themselves unprepared to manage the large portfolios of vacant homes that they now have. Reselling homes can be difficult because the homes have lost value, and in fact, the market values of entire neighborhoods, as we've discussed throughout this summit, have fallen. Today, we have two great examples of communities that are making headway. Cleveland and Boston are two very different cities with two very different housing markets, but they face the same challenges, and each are making strides that provide promising models for other communities. In Cleveland, the Cleveland community leaders are responding in two ways that focus on assets and management. They are directing efforts at the economics of foreclosure, taking steps to shift more financial responsibilities for REO properties to the banks, landlords, and investors that own them. They are threatening to demolish dangerous buildings, pressing code violations, filing lawsuits, and making it harder to walk away from vacant and foreclosed homes. They are also creating initiatives that encourage responsible management and redevelopment, rehabbing vacant properties in targeted areas, leveraging existing assets, land banking, and engaging organizations and institutions in long-term redevelopment plans for vacant property. In Boston, the Boston community leaders are leveraging partnerships to address foreclosures and REOs, and to assist many occupants to hold on to their homes. One innovation is aimed at stabilizing neighborhoods hardest hit by foreclosures by, among other things, buying bank-owned homes at discounted present market values, and reselling them to existing homeowners. Research has also allowed leaders to better understand the challenges facing low-income borrowers, leading to more education to help them with budgeting, banking, and with understanding the real cost of owning a home and maintaining it. Our panelists today will talk also about the lessons that they've learned that can be applied to communities across the country. These lessons include realizing the value of strong code enforcement, planning ahead for sustainable reuse of vacant properties, and acting swiftly to prevent vacancies in the first place and to assist more people to remain in their homes. Providing us with some great insight today, we have an esteemed panel of experts who include Frank Ford from Neighborhood Progress Incorporated, Judge Ray Pianca from the Cleveland Housing Court, We have Elise Cherry from Boston Community Capital, and then Evelyn Friedman from the city of Boston. So please help me in welcoming our panel, first of all. Each member of the panel will provide a brief introduction statement, and then I will follow that with a question for each, and then we will have plenty of time for your questions. And so we'll start with Frank.
Thank you. I'm going to do a brief commercial announcement first to invite all of you to Cleveland October 13th through 15th for the National Vacant Properties Conference being sponsored by, it's called Reclaiming Vacant Properties, and it's Dan Kildee and Jennifer Leonard with the Center for Community Solutions. I have your name. Whoops. It's the new name. Well, it's better than if I said the old name. So, I mean, at least I got part of the new Center for Community Progress. Right. So please take a look at that. You can Google it or you can talk to Jennifer and get information about it, but I would hope that you consider coming. What I'm going to do on my part of the session is first show you a short video of a distressed REO property to ground this into some reality, then look at what were the key decisions that were made to lead to this property getting to this point, who's making those decisions, and what can we do to influence the business behavior that made those decisions. The video is not a staged video. This is not like the guy who does those wilderness things and he's got a crew if something happens. I shouldn't have done this, but I went to this house alone, and you'll see a Burger King bag on this step, so it was somebody there. I don't really know, but it's starting in midstream, and I'm going to end it when it's over, or when it's... Go ahead. Do we have sound? If we don't have sound...
It's serviced by home...
Well, there's rain on the umbrella I was holding. That's the crackling sound.
My name is Frank Ford. I'm executive director of Cleveland Housing Renewal Project, a subsidiary of Neighborhood Progress Incorporated. I'm standing out here in front of 1232 Addison in the St. Clair Superior neighborhood in the city of Cleveland. It is May 8th. Approximately 12:30 in the afternoon. This is a house owned by Wells Fargo, and when I was out here last Saturday, it was wide open and vacant. It's serviced by Home Ec. There's some stickers on the window from Home Ec. And when I was out here before, the side door was wide open, and there was water rushing in the basement. Side door still wide open. And I think I'm going to go inside. Anybody here? I think you can hear the water rushing in the basement. Door. It's probably not enough light to see. I'm holding the camera over the basement stairs. And I think that's it. I don't think I want to be here too much longer.
Okay, we can stop. Now for the serious part. This was an Argent loan. Argent, for those who don't know, was probably one of the most irresponsible subprime lenders. The loan was bought by Wells Fargo, was foreclosed on and taken back at sheriff's sale in 2008. Wells then sold it for $2,500 to a company called Best Buy Properties. They put it on the internet, and a week later, somebody in England, some guy who I feel really sorry for this guy, he paid $4,150, so Wells made $2,500, got something back. Best Buy got $1,600, and this guy in England, who I've been trying to get a hold of, by the way, bought this property thinking probably turn-of-the-century house, $4,000. How could I lose? Well, the way he's going to lose, it's headed for demolition. It'll be a $10,000 demolition. It's a pretty big house. He's going to have a vacant lot worth nothing or have a negative value. And considering the decisions, one more thing. Wells saw this video before they sold this property. They saw the video. They knew the condition of this property. This is not a candidate for a first look program. And I'm a big believer in the first look programs, but not for distressed low-value property. So the decisions, what were the decisions that were made? Well, first of all, buying an urgent loan, buying probably thousands of them. Where's the due diligence in looking at that? By the time that loan was bought, certainly Argent's track record was known, their default rate. So there's, to me, gross negligence in even making the decision to buy the loan and become the mortgage holder. Second, choosing to foreclose rather than modify. Was that even looked at? Somebody probably made some judgment about this. We're not going to modify. Well, if this was a $100,000 loan, what if they'd written off $30,000 in principal? That's extreme. But consider it compared to what they ended up with. Third, failing to maintain the property. There are business judgments that go into the decision not to keep that up to code. That's a criminal matter. In Cleveland, these are criminal codes, so it's criminal behavior. Fourth, dumping the property to some irresponsible flipper. Those decisions, now let's look at who made those decisions. It really comes down to two types of entities that would be doing it. Either a depository bank as a trustee for a loan pool. So the mortgage might say, in this case, it would say U.S. Bank, trustee for the XYZ loan pool. Or are the decisions made by a servicer? Well, it could be Wells Fargo serviced it, or it could be U.S. Bank serviced it. So those are the two categories. Now, I've got four slides I want to look at just to give you an insight into this. Here are the top 20 plaintiffs foreclosing on subprime loans in the Cleveland area. Notice the predominance of depository institutions regulated by CRA, regulated by one of the four regulatory agencies. It's a high number. Go to the next slide. Oh, I can do that. I will do that. Okay, top 20 buyers at sheriff sale. Again, look at the predominance of depository institutions regulated by CRA. Third slide. Top 10 residential servicers ranked by total servicing volume in 2010, quarter one. With the exception of PHH Mortgage number 9, I believe they are all depository institutions regulated again by CRA. And notice the last column is one I added. The depository bank market share of servicing is 80% in the top grouping. So whether here's why this is important. Well, let me go to one more slide, one more. Here are the top 20 sellers of REO property for less than $10,000. This is the distressed property. Again, the predominance of depository institutions. I will note that Fannie Mae, of course, as you've been hearing about, has changed their practices. Their numbers would be less now. But here's why this is important. We often find ourselves trying to address a property, and we'll talk to the mortgage holder or the REO owner, and they'll say, well, we're just the trustee. You've got to talk to the servicer. Talk to the servicer, and they say, well, wait, we don't have legal title to this. You've got to talk to the trustee. So it's back and forth finger-pointing, and I finally came to the conclusion in preparing these remarks, it doesn't matter. It's the industry, the depository banks who are regulated by CRA, that predominantly, one way or the other, are involved in the decisions that lead to these properties. I had some specific recommendations, and I only have, I'll just try to quickly say this. The number one, code enforcement. It was said in the last session, absolutely, code enforcement needs to be increased. We have a very good judge in Cleveland, but we could even be doing better in terms of code enforcement. Second,
did you say he could be doing better?
No, yes. Judge, he did not.
Well, you're doing fine. The second, I know this is President Pianalto said that it is questionable to what extent can CRA be used. But I guess I would suggest that the regulatory agencies really look at pushing the envelope on this, because you've got this regulated industry engaged in these practices. You could be including in your exams what they're doing with loan modifications, disposing of REO property, and how that's being done. And I'm out of time. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Judge?
Thank you. The Cleveland Housing Court was established 30 years ago as a problem-solving therapeutic court by state statute in the state of Ohio, and then there was the Toledo Housing Court after, and then the Columbus Environmental Court, but all municipal courts have a housing-type docket. I've been on the bench for 15 years, and the type of cases that I've seen has changed drastically in those 15 years. In the beginning, it was an owner, maybe an owner-occupant or an absentee owner in an inner-ring suburb that had a hanging gutter or their trim needed painting. I'm still seeing the case with hanging gutters and trim needing painting, but the house is now condemned, stripped out. The legal title owner has walked from the property. The mortgage company has walked from the property, and leaving the citizens of Cleveland to deal with the aftermath. The housing court, as in its role as a problem-solving therapeutic court, tries to work on a number of issues having to do with real estate in the city of Cleveland and the village of Brattonall. We have very few cases from the village of Brattonall, which is a high-end community adjacent to Cleveland. In 2005, the National Vacant Properties Campaign did a study on Cleveland and called Cleveland at the Crossroads, which is available online. And it outlined that there are 10 to 25,000 vacant structures in the city. We really don't know how many. And that one abandoned property, of course, takes value away from the other properties. But the lack of effective code enforcement facilitates flipping. And the bottom line to that report was that it's just too easy to own vacant and abandoned property in the city of Cleveland. And, of course, the foreclosures that we started to notice in the late 90s accelerated. And what are our challenges currently? Well, you see up there an ad from eBay in which lists the property. 22 bidders bid this house up to about $1,200. And the four-family brick, the next one, 22 bidders bid it up to about $1,200. But you also see ads up on Craigslist, which outlines investors, Ohio bulk liquidation, and that you can buy three-bedroom properties for $7,000. And unless you think that you in your states can't be affected, the ad goes on, more properties in other states available. And so we're seeing issues of property owners no longer in inner suburbs or owner-occupants, but last week I had property owners from Belize, Israel, China, Saskatchewan, who have owned and purchased properties on the Internet. And, of course, those photos of those properties are much like the dating websites. What what you see isn't necessarily what you're going to find when you meet the property in person, as Frank has outlined in his video. And so we have unrecorded interest, titles flipped without benefit of being filed at the county recorder's office. Online purchases, service issues are difficult for out-of-state buyers and out-of-the-country owners. And then there are business entities that are unregistered to do business in our state and may even be defunct. So the court had to change its way of doing business, and there are a number of things that we had to undertake. One aspect that involved corporations. The court's ongoing challenge is compelling corporate defendants to appear in court. In general, the city of Cleveland does not name officers as defendants, although they can. They name the corporations. So several unique issues arise when a corporation or other entity is named as a defendant. The use of corporations as statutory agents for other corporations often complicates service, as does the failure of out-of-state corporations to register with the state. And unlike individuals who are subject to arrest if they fail to appear when summoned, corporations and other entities cannot be arrested, nor are the corporate officers subject to arrest. So the court had established a corporation docket, given our limitations, which requires the corporations to come in to court after being served. And if they fail to come in, we send out courtesy notices apprising them of potential contempt of court. If they fail to come in, then they can be fined $1,000 a day, which is converted to civil judgment and collection. Their properties then are leaned up. But we find that the courtesy notices are quite helpful, particularly with some of the corporate officers when their spouses receive them. Notice of hearings in Cleveland Housing Court, it's helped quite a bit to bring in corporate defendants. We've also established a clean hands docket. Clean hands approach is for our eviction section of our court. It prevents a property owner with an outstanding warrant in criminal housing court case from invoking the power of the court in the eviction action until the owner has addressed the criminal warrant issues. Previously, we had seen a number of corporations and individuals filing eviction actions, but we had warrants for them on the criminal side of the court. We stopped, said, unless you come to court with clean hands, address those issues, you cannot move forward on your evictions. We've developed comprehensive plea agreements, and you know, all of those late-night infomercials and other media have brought people into the real estate market who probably shouldn't be. And sometimes a city will bring them in on code enforcement on one case, which is just the tip of the iceberg on their property ownership. And as a result, in order to mitigate their substantial fines, of which a corporation can be fined $5,000 a day for each day out of compliance, we encourage them to enter into a comprehensive agreement. And if they do that and bring all of their properties in the city of Cleveland, not only those before the court, and develop a plan for transitioning those properties or repairing them, those fines can be mitigated. We also have looked at a few other ways to maintain the cases of the properties that are boarded before the court, such as you look at the artistic boarding, which we have a pilot project for all boarded houses that are before the court, and while we can work to free up the mortgage and or work so the city could tear down with the consent of the owner the property or sell it to a beneficial owner. And we've just recently started a victim restitution look in which potential victims have been notified if they believe they've been harmed by the criminal actions of property owners who fail to maintain their property, those properties that are in housing court, and the court will issue its decision around the middle of this month on victim restitution for neighbors of properties. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Elise.
Well, thanks very much. I'm delighted to see everyone here, and many thanks to the Federal Reserve for creating this conference and also for all of their focus on the issues of foreclosure and REO and vacancy. I am from Boston Community Capital. We are a community development financial institution. We've been around now for 25 years. I shudder to say, but I've actually been around for 25 years too, although for the first dozen or so, actually, as a member of the board of directors. We started as a $3,500 entity, and we now have about $600 million under management. We have financed probably 10,000 units of housing, a couple of small venture funds. We have a national tax credit process. We're actually the largest third-party owner of solar production facilities in the Commonwealth, which we've got up all over affordable housing developments across the Commonwealth and a variety of other things as well. Back in 2006 and 2007, as we began to see the issues with respect to housing prices in the neighborhoods, it became clear to us that we needed to move from our traditional approach of working through intermediaries and begin to work more directly with the ultimate homeowners. We put together a program that we call the Sun Initiative for Stabilizing Urban Neighborhoods. We came up with the name after realizing that we ourselves were falling all over NSB 1 and 2 and all of the others, so we call it the Sun Initiative. And the goal here really is to buy properties. Our sweet spot is post-foreclosure and pre-eviction, although we're actually set up to be able to buy any kind of asset at all, whether it's a loan or an actual property, and then turn around and sell it right back to the people who are living there. By doing that, we not only stabilize the family, we keep kids in their same schools, keep friendship circles and social circles and so forth in place. We keep the homes from becoming vacant, and so they don't then become a blight in the neighborhood. The way we do this is we actually work with a group of community outreach partners, folks like Greater Boston Legal Services and the Foreclosure Counselors and a group around called City Life, urban ministers, we're out talking to everybody in sight to find people who are in homes who have some steady source of income that might allow them to support a mortgage that's consistent with current market values, but who in fact are in foreclosure because their mortgages are often twice what current market values are. We underwrite the people who come in. It's a full underwriting process. When we find somebody who meets the criteria that we have, we then go out to the lender, or in some cases the asset manager, depending on what stage the property's in, and provide market-level data, really zip code-level data, about the value of distressed properties in that zip code. And then we offer to buy on basically a market rate and cash purchase. We can close on a dime. And then once we get them, we mark them up about 25%, which is really the differential between a distressed sale and a non-distressed sale, and sell them back to the homeowner. We also put what we call a shared appreciation second mortgage on it. The way it works is if, for example, you're paying, and we provide a mortgage, I should say that. So if, for example, the new mortgage that we're providing is equal to, say, half of your original outstanding principal amount, of the outstanding principal of your original mortgage, you would get 50% appreciation at the other end. Now, I have to tell you, in light of where prices are and where they're likely to be over time, I don't really think that there's going to be much value in terms of that shared appreciation second. What it does, though, is really help us to screen out speculators and other folks who are really looking to flip properties quickly. So from that perspective, it's a very useful tool, but we never agree to sell it. And, over time, it'll be interesting to see, but I would not view it as a profit center. Anyway, in order to develop funds for this, we actually funded initially through our own money, money that we had raised as a result of fees we were able to acquire through national tax credit transactions. We then went out to raise funds from the community, and most of almost $50 million has come in from private individuals and a few foundations. We're at about 42 now, I think, on what we're hoping will be a $50 million pool. The goal here is to get that money out, and then once it's out and loans have been seasoned, to package up the revenues from the various loans, not the servicing, but the income from the loans, and turn around and sell that and use that money to recapitalize and do the whole thing all over again. So we think with the initial $50 million pool that we're going to be able to do about 2,000 units of housing. We're currently focused just on Boston and Revere. Revere is an adjacent town to Boston. It really has the same characteristics as many of Boston's low-income neighborhoods. It's also in Suffolk County, which is the same county. I will tell you that that's none of those are the reasons that we're doing it in Revere. We're doing it in Revere because that's where I grew up. I came through Revere Public Schools, and I suspect the home I lived in was probably one that is currently in difficulties now. So we have all of that in. We are now up somewhere north of 85 transactions since the beginning of the year. We're at about $10 million in terms of money out the door. I think that the money that has come in, it's all debt, except, well, there's $3.5 million of upfront loss reserves that came in as well. The rest of it is 5-year, 4.25% money. And so, the great challenge here, one of the great challenges is we've borrowed 5-year money and we're making 30-year loans. And we've been very upfront about that with all of our lenders. And the goal, of course, is through the recapitalization process to be able to pay them back. My own sense about this is that the first, assuming that we succeed, and I do assume we'll succeed, at a recapitalization process, the first time we do that, we'll actually free up a whole lot more money. The concern, of course, that people have is whether they're actually going to have to run down the loans as opposed to getting repaid in 5 years. I just want to say a couple of other things here about some of what we've discovered and also some of what we think the future might look like. Our mission at Boston Community Capital is to help build healthy communities where low-income people live and work. So we never have described ourselves or thought of ourselves as totally housing-focused. One of the really interesting things that we've discovered as we've gone through this process is we've gotten a much deeper understanding about the cash flow and expenses and budgets for low-income families. And when you really look at what's going on there, housing costs are probably the biggest piece. The car loan is often the second biggest piece, and utility costs are the third biggest piece. And the reason the car loan is the second biggest piece is because folks are getting car loans at, it's not unsurprising for us to see 23% car loans. We've actually seen them as high as 56%. It's simply one more way in which the neighborhoods are being raped. And again, when you look at utility costs, there are lots of programs around attempting to either do conservation or efficiency or whatever, but they're very complicated for anybody to manage. You've got to go all over the place. And you're talking about folks who have two jobs and, you know, and are raising kids off. And so it's a difficult kind of process. So one of the things we've really begun to think about is, you know, basically we're buying properties right now. I think we're averaging roughly 47% of outstanding principal amount in terms of our purchase. You mark them up. We're still at a point where, because we're also reducing the interest rate, I think we're now at between 6.25% and 6.375%. You're generally whacking half off of the monthly mortgage payment, often as much as $1,500. If you could, in addition to that, and we're actually beginning to work with a group that can finance cars at a much lower price that we think we can actually bring some capital to the table for, you could whack another $400 or $500 off of that. And we're really trying to look at all of these various utility programs and figure out whether we can become a conduit, essentially, so that you can go to a homeowner and say, look, you know, we can do the mortgage, we can do the car, and we can do the utility costs. And overall, you're starting to look at something between $2,000 and $2,500 that you've removed from the monthly expenses of a low-income family. If you can do that on an after-tax basis, you know, you're up somewhere around $35,000 or $40,000. It's a huge, huge impact. So that's really something that we're thinking about over time. The other interesting question, I think, is what happens at the end of this crisis, right? You know, so we... however it happens, and God knows I think it's a long process, but the vacancies, the foreclosures, the REO flushes through the system, people come back in and start lending again. What's really to stop the same sort of predatory lending processes from happening? I mean, I know that there's a lot of work in the government level in terms of trying to assure consistent regulation. I also know there are a lot of political problems with that. So we're really wondering about whether we shouldn't become the go-to mortgage lender for all of these various neighborhoods so that we can really assure over time that people actually have safe, consistent mortgages that are appropriate for the homes that they have and the kinds of income that they have. And I see my time is up, and so I'll stop.
Thank you.
Is there somebody doing
time? Evelyn? Judge, can you pass the question?
Good morning, still. I'm Evelyn Friedman, and I'm the director of the Department of Neighborhood Development for the City of Boston, and we're the Affordable Housing and Small Business Development Agency in the city. And I have a disclosure, which is that for many years I worked at a community development corporation, and that, I think, will color some of what I have to say. The city has, we've sort of identified five key challenges related to the foreclosure or how we're trying to address foreclosure problems. We want to help home buyers compete in the market. We are trying to address and dealing with developer capacity, trying to figure out what to do about competition from investors, targeting certain neighborhoods for a major impact, and then trying to prevent the abandonment of REOs. What we're trying to do for the most part, or where we started, was to try and help home buyers buy properties. And we're using a portion of our NSP money to help homeowners or home buyers rehab properties and acquire properties. But it hasn't worked as well as we would like. The reason is, and we'll discuss this a little more further later, is that the home buyers just can't compete using the NSP money, for one, and they can't compete with investor owners. Even so, we've been able to help about 52 home buyers buy REO properties. This is a property. And on Millett Street in Dorchester, a section of Boston. And, you know, it's interesting when people talk about how much the properties are being acquired for. This one was acquired for $290,000. So one of the things I think that's a regional issue is how much properties actually are worth, how you've priced them, and so on. The city provided $8,700 for down payment assistance and then $50,000 for rehab assistance. These are kinds of properties that we're trying very hard to assist home buyers in buying, but as I said earlier, it's very difficult for the home buyers to compete with investors. And part of the problem is the mortgage process, acquiring mortgages for the home buyers. And part of the problem is, you know, as I said, competing. We have developed a web page where we're trying to assist home buyers in locating these properties. And we have classes that we run and that we've other nonprofits in the city provide for people who are interested in buying foreclosed properties, and the demand is huge. Huge. The problem is trying to get homebuyers directly into buying the properties. The second problem that we're facing is developer capacity, and I think a number of folks have talked about this problem. We have a very robust nonprofit housing development community in the city. Most of the nonprofits have been focused on larger properties. So they have to retool their thinking and also their process when we start looking at these smaller properties. This particular property, that's our mayor. We have to have a picture of the mayor, of course. This particular property was one of the methods that we're using to help nonprofits acquire properties is to negotiate the deal with the bank, with the lender, and then transfer our interest to a nonprofit so that it never comes directly to us. And the city is buying property, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But once we buy the property, because we're government, we're regulated, and we have a very specific process that we have to use, which is quite lengthy, in order to dispose of property. So one way that we're trying to avoid doing that is to negotiate a deal with the lender, transfer our interest to the nonprofit who we've pre-approved. One of the reasons that the nonprofits don't want to do this sort of work is because, and I think some other folks have talked about this, is that the amount of money that they can actually earn in fee and overhead is minimal and doesn't really cover their costs. So one of the things we want to do is to see if we can change that dynamic. However, because of that problem, one of the things that we're doing, and I think a number of others have spoken about this, is we work with a lot of small developers who we have feel confidence in and who have either agreed to sell the property to a home buyer or we feel comfortable with their capacity to rent the properties. One of the other options that we're exploring and we have been working on is to use these properties that the city acquires for supportive housing. The other side of this is an opportunity for us to use this for supportive housing for homeless families or individuals. In this particular case, this property was acquired by a nonprofit working with a private developer, and they're going to use it for youth aging out of foster care, which is a burgeoning problem in our city and in the state. But it's an opportunity because oftentimes locating properties like this for supportive housing is difficult. And in this case, because we're just rehabbing or somebody else is rehabbing an abandoned property, it makes it much easier for siting this kind of a program. One of our problems or challenges is competition from investors. Right now, the city has 852 foreclosed properties. We've had about 2,900 properties go through the foreclosure process in the city. But of 161 properties were bought in the city by only 25 individuals, and when they're resold, they're not being rehabbed. So people are flipping these properties. And this is one of the things that we're very, very concerned about and has been one of the major issues that we've been trying to address by acquiring the properties ourselves. People talked about code enforcement. We work very closely with our code enforcement department, and we have a receivership program that we've started with them. One of the things, though, that we've done is this is the city of Boston. The yellow is the NSP area, and the darker areas are where we've focused, targeted our acquisitions. Now, acquiring property by the city is very controversial, as you can well imagine. My department is the department in the city that receives tax foreclosed properties. So really, most of the time, what we're trying to do is sell tax foreclosed property, not acquire anything. So it's controversial to do so. Nonetheless, we've acquired about 54 properties, and as I said before, we've helped another 52 individuals or families buy properties. But in comparison, only about 12 properties have been bought by nonprofits in the city, which gives you an example of part of the problem, what we need to do in order, in our city anyway, to try and address this problem. If we can't get it's difficult for homebuyers to buy the property, and it's difficult for nonprofits to buy the property, what are the alternatives? Finally, one of the things that we're doing, which is highly controversial, and our mayor says to me at least once a month, now why are we doing this, is that we are buying occupied properties. We've only bought about 10 so far, but the reason that we're doing that is to prevent eviction. About two-thirds of the people in our city who are impacted by the foreclosure problem are tenants, because they are being evicted, and we have many triple-deckers. So we're trying to prevent those folks from being evicted, but also abandonment of the property, and thereby having people occupy the properties and remain in the properties so that they stay part of the community and they prevent abandonment. I'm at the end of my time now. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Frank, you get the first question, and we could clearly see from your video that you, I think in another life, you want to be Geraldo Rivera or somebody like that.
I'm working on it.
You go through these vacant homes. And we could clearly see that some homes definitely need to be demolished because they are beyond repair. What advice would you give communities who are, you know, thinking about revamping or starting the use of demolition as a way to stabilize neighborhoods?
Well, the very first thing that I think any community should do, and it's the good, I think it's a really good aspect of NSP2, it's the idea of targeting for impact, whatever your activity is, whether it's rehab, demolition, to consider where are the places you want to invest your resources. Quite frankly, we have 11,500 vacant properties, or at least that is the count. I know the judge said we don't know, but there is a count. We've gotten better at that. 11,500 vacant properties, the average demolition cost it's a little below 10, but that's a $100 million problem. Rehab, if you do the rehab properly with our market, it's like a $40,000 gap. That's a $40 million problem. Well, we don't have either of those numbers to work with. And I don't know if any communities do have all the money they need. So the very first thing is targeting and looking at the places where, if you're going to do demolition, rehab, whatever it is, where are you going to get some visible return for that? I mean, and the sad thing about that means that there are places you're saying, okay, we're not going to do something over here. But taking the peanut butter and spreading it evenly is – unfortunately, I don't think that's the way to go. It's a very tough decision. So targeting is the very first thing. Your question is really a community that has not really done much demolition and is now looking that maybe they have to. The first thing is there's getting over the decision to do it. Because Cleveland didn't always do that. We only did 200 demos a year historically. Now we're doing 1,700. And most of the people like myself who've been in this for 20-some years, if we weren't diehard housing preservationists, we leaned in the direction of you don't knock stuff down when it's got oak flooring and it's turn of the century. But to not do that subjects Mrs. Jones, who lives next door with her two kids, to have to live near that house with the doors open. And it'll get boarded. But then they'll be open again a month later. So there's a health and safety issue. So getting over the decision, having a rationale for the decision, and being comfortable with the decision that you know some things have to come down. So I may be drifting too much, and maybe I didn't give you as much of a direct answer. That was a good answer.
That was great.
Okay.
Thank you. You know, Judge, we've been hearing a lot about these nuisance-based suits. Tell us about how successful they've been, especially with out-of-state financial institutions.
Well, there's two forms of nuisance abatement action that are brought to the housing court. One brought by the city under criminal code action. Possible penalty could be $5,000 a day for each day out of compliance. It's not unusual for corporations to have fines of $25,000, $30,000, far in excess of the value of the property. It's difficult obtaining service at times once the companies are served, bringing them in. That's why we had to establish our corporation docket. There's another side, which is the civil side, nuisance abatement action, receivership type actions, temporary restraining orders, and injunctions. And you could ask the plaintiff in one of the receivership actions, seeking nuisance abatement, how successful it was. But the one thing that I find as we bring the parties together in court, there's a dialogue that helps not only in that case but with other cases and other pieces of the inventory of the property owners and apprising them of what their obligations are under the law. But in addition, it's hard to believe that sophisticated corporations, when they became owners, legal title owners of a property, didn't research what the local ordinances were, what you're required to do. And unfortunately, after a few cases, they now are researching that. And but if we can get a positive outcome with within the walls of the courtroom between the plaintiffs and the defendants, plaintiffs in a criminal action being the city and the defendant property owner, or plaintiffs being a nonprofit group, could be the city and the property owner, that's what our goal is.
Thank you. Elise, tell us more about how you've been able to convince these lenders and servicers to sell you homes at market values. Because I know a lot of communities are probably very interested in that process.
Well, if we're dealing with asset managers because the property is post foreclosure, it's really the most straightforward approach. You have an asset manager who is incented to sell. That's really how they get paid. And when we're able to provide zip code level market data, you know, really the argument is, look, nobody's going to pay you more than this. That's the price, right? And as I say, there's a pretty significant differential for distressed versus non-distressed properties. The other thing, and I suppose this really gets to be the most critical issue, whether it's pre or post foreclosure, is helping lenders and servicers and asset managers understand that conditions in particular neighborhoods and particular zip codes don't have a lot to do with what's happening in the greater Boston area. So, for example, if you look at Chip Case's index, he says, you know, Boston isn't down very much. And he's right. I mean, in the greater sense, if it's Brookline or Newton or Weston, for those of you who know Boston suburbs, they're just fine. But when you look at some of the neighborhoods in Boston, or you look at Lynn, or you look at Lawrence, or some of our other low-income areas, we're seeing drops as much as 72%. And so, and a lot of that is because, as I think this is no surprise to anybody, once mortgages were unshackled from income, there was nothing to stop a run-up in prices. So income has been basically stable over a long period of time, but there was a huge run-up in price during the period of credit that was available without underwriting. And so it's all just come back down again. So essentially it's back being tied to income. And there's a process of needing to explain that to the folks who actually hold the loan or hold the asset. And, you know, they have a hard time accepting it sometimes, but the data really speaks for itself. And so that's what we've done. And you know, one of the challenges is it's not like you can go into a neighborhood and say, okay, who's the biggest lender? We'll deal with that lender, right? I mean, first off, there are many, many different lenders and services in the neighborhood. And second, the folks that we can work with, that is people who have some kind of stable income, even if it's nowhere close to supporting their own mortgage, are scattered across all kinds of lenders. So unfortunately, in that sense as well, it's a retail process, right? We attempted early on to buy some portfolios and had a very difficult time coming to agreement on numbers on that. I mean, we thought, you know, maybe 20 to 25%, and they thought 65 cents. So, you know, so, but I think that, and this is something that I think there can be a lot of assistance, both through governmental entities, through the Federal Reserve, through the press and so forth, really helping lenders writ broad understand truly what's happening to values in the neighborhoods. And my current sense is that they're actually dropping again. So one of the interesting questions is not staying on a trend that says, well, appraisals are coming in and they're flat or going up a little bit, but making certain that you're actually paying attention to the real trend, which I think is a little bit downward at this stage.
You know, Evelyn, tell us, you know, we've been hearing a lot over the last day and a half about the public-private partnerships and how effective they can be. Tell us, what do you think, from a city's perspective, the role of the city is in bringing the private sector together with the public sector to address some of the neighborhood stabilization issues?
Well, I think the city, and especially local government, and I want to say especially our mayor, has been very active in trying to get both the lenders, the nonprofits, and other quasi-publics to the table to address all of these issues. We've, for example, worked very closely with BCC on...
Evelyn is a former board member.
And former borrower.
Former borrower. And former landlord.
And with other with home buyers, when we discover home buyers who are, or homeowners who are still in their properties, informing Boston Community Capital about them, and bringing all the various components to the table to say, what are the things that we can begin to do to address these problems? And just internally to the city, we work together quite well with the other departments so that we can make sure that all the various things in a particular neighborhood are addressed. Some of us have talked about targeted neighborhoods. Well, when we target a neighborhood, we're not just talking about we're going to target this neighborhood to deal with the foreclosure problem, but we also want to get the sidewalk redone, the street repaved, trees put on the streets, and so on. And the mayor has been very focused on making sure that those things happen on these very difficult and high foreclosure areas.
Now let's open it up for questions from the audience. Just as a reminder, please wait for a microphone, and also please tell us your name and the organization that you represent.
Hello, my name is Lisa Rice. I'm with the National Fair Housing Alliance, and my question relates to the abandonment issue. One of the challenges that we're facing in trying to assist our member organizations in operating their loss mitigation and foreclosure prevention programs is the issue of abandonment. And what we're hearing anecdotally quite a lot is that the attorney who is either representing the lender or the trustee will send a notice to the borrower, the homeowner, that they're in default and they're about to be foreclosed on and they have to vacate the premises. The borrower typically does not want to be embarrassed by having the sheriff show up at their home to evict them. So the borrower actually vacates the premises, but then the lender or the trustee doesn't proceed with filing the foreclosure action. And unfortunately, the borrower has gone and cannot be notified that the foreclosure was not filed. They're not being foreclosed upon. And they don't know that they still technically, legally own the property. So the borrower does own the property, but is nowhere to be found. And I'm just wondering to what extent you're seeing this, if you are seeing it in your jurisdictions, and if so, to what degree you are seeing it, and if you've developed any policies or practices to try and address the problem.
Whoever. Go ahead.
Yeah. We see it quite frequently in court, and it had us develop a program. Every foreclosure filed in the city of Cleveland, the court sends a letter out apprising them that there's help available with several groups, but also that they should not leave that property until the sheriff puts them out or until they give someone else the deed. And it could be a deed in lieu of foreclosure. And we also give them our phone number. We run a housing clinic at the housing court, and we have 10 specialists that are available to discuss with them what they can do. I usually see cases where people receive their notice that they're in foreclosure. They leave the house. They may have filed bankruptcy. Their bankruptcy attorney said, well, you know, this financial burden's off of your shoulders. This is even for investors. And they're quite surprised when they see me because the mortgage company has dropped the foreclosure action. They're still the legal title owner. They're being pulled into court, criminal defendants, facing having to pay for the demolition of a property that is now vandalized and worthless. In fact, it has a negative value. So we tried to swim upstream a little bit with the bankruptcy attorneys, sending them letters that some of their clients may be confused and that although they're relieved of the financial burdens, they may still be the legal title owners. Unless the mortgage company, after the asset is abandoned out of the estate, picks up the foreclosure action again and takes it, which we're finding many times they do not, leaving that title toxic. So the people are in a gridlock. Within the last year, we've had a relief through the county land bank, which will take those properties if they can work on a release of that mortgage lien. And so that's what our housing court specialists do every single day with people who find themselves owning properties that they thought that they lost.
I have just two things. I certainly would agree that you hit the nail on the head in terms of what's going on in people's minds. Why would they even do that? Why would they leave? And I think you're right. On a macro level and a micro level, two ways to look at it. The macro level would be public officials. There are some in Cleveland who've been very bold and outspoken about saying, don't move out. I mean, when that gets out there in a public way, it becomes a little more acceptable. Okay, I'm not alone. This is a problem that's not just me, and you know, maybe it's okay for me to stay. So that's just setting a framework for that, setting a climate that it's okay, you should be staying in your home, don't leave. And second is on a micro level, we actually, and this is something that's not practical all over the city, but we have taken the target neighborhoods where we're doing NSP work, and we're actually going door to door. And we are using data. Yesterday, Terry Theologidis, I probably butchered his name again. Terry, you're back there. CoreLogic. We paid about $10,000 to buy data from CoreLogic 2 years. Yeah. We got it was worth it because what we got were all of the ARM loans that were going to reset. We knew exactly where properties were that were likely to go into foreclosure. So we have been going out. It's very labor intensive. You couldn't do this in a whole city. But again, back to a targeted approach, using your resources for impact, we're actually going out. And that gets the buzz out there amongst block clubs and neighbors. That, you know what, we should be not moving out in the middle of the night. We should fight back, and there's people who are going to help us.
In Boston, the city's had the Don't Borrow Trouble campaign, which started in Boston. Everything starts in Boston, of course. There was a huge marketing campaign, which continues, about coming in to talk to either the city or our partners, our nonprofit partners, about how to stem the tide of a foreclosure. And the other thing that we do on a daily basis is the city, our department, sends out, anytime there's a petition sent to a foreclosure petition at the very beginning is sent to a homeowner, we send out a postcard saying, here are the places to go, here are the things to do. Please call us or one of our partners. And so we've now saved over 1,000 potentially foreclosed homeowners. So we have 1,000 people, families that have not been foreclosed, and more than 1,000 in the city, and that's really made a huge impact. And it's not targeted. It's anyone who gets a foreclosure petition in the city.
You know, the other thing that I would add to this is there's some self-help going on. We have a group in Boston called City Life Vita Urbana, and when people start getting close to that moment where they're about to be evicted, they go and they demonstrate, and they get a whole bunch of folks from the neighborhood, and they go out there, and they stand there, and they form human chains, and, you know, the sheriff sort of shows up and says, you know what, not me, and goes back again. Okay. We have a great sheriff, too. But you know, so... So they've actually been quite successful, and they've been out really organizing in the neighborhoods, and they're a great partner with us. They sometimes claim to have us in a little bit more of a bear hug than we're comfortable with, but in fact, often what will happen is the lender is then forestalled for a while, and then they will send us the homeowner, and then we can often be in a position in which we can actually help. So I do think that government has an extraordinary role to play here, but I also think that good old-fashioned community organizing, which is not what we do, has a role as well. Well, City Life, I'll just tell you, has gone a little bit farther than that, too, in the sense of they've gotten to some vacant homes and moved in some old furniture and called up the lender and said, you know what, we've occupied your home, we're squatting. And, you know, it just sends everybody through the roof, and then the lender shows up, and then there's a big thing, and then the Boston Globe calls up, and then, you know, and then they say, well, Boston Community Capital, what's your view on squatting? And I say, you know, what do you want out of me? I'm a financial institution. I don't have a view on squatting. And why aren't you talking about the public safety issues associated with people coming and dumping furniture in the street? So, you know, all of that stuff starts to get picked up, and people in the neighborhoods, I think, start to feel a little more empowered about all of this. And I also think creating communities around folks who are either at risk of foreclosure or something we're starting to do with the folks who have come through our mortgage program begins to help as well, because isolation is clearly one of the hallmarks of poverty, and it's a really significant problem when it's attached to shame and homelessness as well. So I think in all of those ways, people are working on this.
What other questions do we have?
Frank Alexander with the Center for Community Progress. Frank, a follow-up question to you. I was intrigued by the slides you showed, that you presented, where you showed the percentage of the mortgages and the REO held by the nationally regulated depository institutions. But I'm curious about what you didn't say, linking to Judge Pianca, and I'm asking you, Frank, because I don't know if it's appropriate for me to ask the judge. How many of those depository institutions, federally regulated depository institutions, have been convicted of criminal violations 10 or more times?
That's just as a coincidence. I don't think the judge knows this, but I have been talking to his staff about getting the data. I hope that's okay. I think it's public record. And I was going to start looking at that. And I believe that since it is a matter of public record, we're just trying to figure out the logistics of electronically, can we get this to Case Western Reserve University, where all the other data is housed, and can we start looking at it? So I don't know the answer.
The answer is many of them.
Okay.
On that list, many of them.
There is a statistic which let me just throw this in because I didn't mention it earlier. In 2009, there were 3,000 properties sold out of REO by predominantly those in the same institutions. 60% of those sales were for $10,000 or less. So we're talking an extraordinarily high percentage of the REO sales in Cleveland are these distressed properties. It's not a few here and there. They don't all have running water in the basement for the sound effects. But you can find a lot of properties like that.
Questions?
I'm Maya Brennan with the Center for Housing Policy. And I first have a comment. I just wanted to underscore one of the final points that Evelyn had made about the importance of really cleaning up and making sure that the streets are in good shape and that everything else around the neighborhood is good also, because you're not going to have anybody moving into a neighborhood with well-rehabbed homes that looks otherwise like a poor community to be in. And then I had a question about the artistic boarding happening in Cleveland. To what extent is that pilot program going on? Is it just in select targeted areas? And how do you feel about that?
With artistic boarding, it's where the boards are painted on the house. And it's not a solution to the problem. One blogger said it's lipstick on a pig. And it could be, but we have to deal with the pig. And I think it was about 3 years ago, and Robert Klein is here. He sponsored a demonstration project. He's with Safeguard Properties to bring into the Detroit Shoreway neighborhood artistic boarding, the artist from Chicago. And this artist has worked in Minneapolis, Albany, Chicago. And it costs about $1,000 a house, and many of the homes that are in transition aren't going to be torn down right away, or someone isn't going to step forward to rehab them. And so it maintains a less obtrusive negative status quo in the community. And we started with the 15 properties that were boarded that we had defendants in court. So we ordered them artistically boarded. Properties then every week our bailiffs go out to make sure that they're clean, secure, graffiti-free. If they're not, we'll haul the defendants back into court to answer for that. But it shows that the court's eye is on these properties. As we started to do the properties, we started in Slavic Village, it became apparent that the other properties also needed treatment, but they weren't under the court's authority. So the councilman in the area worked with the city to go in under the city administration's nuisance abatement authority that boarded the house to go on and do the artistic boarding. So there's a $10,000 demonstration contract that the city administration has. There may be other entities. I'm going to encourage my defendants, corporate defendants, that have big inventories if they have boarded properties, to take this extra step as a mitigating factor on the substantial fines that they face, to take that property. And because once it's boarded and it shows artistic boarding, that demonstration project in Detroit Shoreway, I think there are 10 properties. Not one of them was broken into. Not one. And the city's always having to reboard properties. And so it shows that there's some interest in the property and someone's keeping an eye on it. And it preserves the asset. And that's what the housing court is, trying to make sure that assets and communities are preserved, and to try to stem the tide of collateral damage on the adjoining neighbors.
Other questions? Let's talk about...
I'm Gina Dunlap from Louisville Metro Government in Kentucky. I'm also an NSP administrator. And we are very fortunate to have a lot of, say, good property management laws and ordinances in place. We've got the nuisance abatements ordinance. We've got abandoned urban property tax penalties. Recently, the Legal Aid Society partnered with the master commissioner, who oversees the foreclosure sales process, to require and mandate mediation before a foreclosure action is put through the court. But what we don't have is an actual housing court or receivership program. And so I'm wondering, from an administrative perspective, what it really takes in terms of budget, staff, and coordination to make that really work. Budgetary resources are scarce. I'm wondering, you know, how much money does it really take, or, you know, other departments are donating staff time, or if you're actually allocating budgetary resources to that effort.
Our housing court was established by statute, and they also established the Toledo Housing Court and Columbus Environmental Court. But there are other courts that work on housing dockets, so they cluster all their housing cases. This would be in smaller communities on one day. The cost, our court's 30 years old. We go to city council. We have 40 staff members of the Cleveland Housing Court, specialists, magistrates, and so the city council reviews those costs. So every court has that type of docket, and in fact, Judge Nowak up in Buffalo has taken the cases and has volunteered to be the housing judge just on a rotation. Judge Milich in Youngstown, Ohio, has agreed to take those cases. And the important component is people to work on problem solving on the staff. And up in Buffalo, there's volunteers. But also, within the framework of Cleveland, it's not just a housing court. It's the CDC community that gives us some options on what to do with the property, a direction for the property, a rehab or part of a plan. Not in all neighborhoods, but in many neighborhoods.
I've got just a quick answer. Costs, we've done 40 cases, filed them. Administrative costs are about $1,500, filing, title searches. The legal work is going to cost you about $10,000 per house, but we're getting that done by Cleveland State's law school. The third cost is the demo or the rehab work, and that's pretty much the same as it would be in any other case.
One last question really quickly.
Well, of course, there's the Boston Housing Court, the first housing court. Memphis has an environmental court. All courts have those type of dockets, but statutory courts, there aren't that many.
Two quick questions and two quick answers, and then we have to end the session. Richard, then Matt.
I'm just curious, when you tear down a house, do the materials get recycled?
That's a great question. I don't have time for everything, but my organization for 2 years has been pioneering a local deconstruction effort to recycle materials. We've done 25 houses. We have yet to prove that this is working. I mean, it's working in terms of the green impact. We're not sure that it's cost effective. But otherwise, in a traditional demo, those materials, the city says they belong to the contractor. When he pulls them out, he can take them somewhere on his own yard if he wants, but they traditionally take them to a dump. I think more and more of them are trying to recycle some of that and sell some of that stuff.
So I'm George McCarthy from the Ford Foundation, otherwise known as MAC. So a comment. I think it's really useful to distinguish between investors and speculators. And then the question, this might be down in the weeds for you, Judge. If you acquire a property on a quitclaim deed, doesn't it actually still carry like tax liens and fines and other penalties that are assigned to the property? So that wouldn't it be useful to get out to the potential speculators out there some knowledge that acquiring a property without a really perfected kind of deed is going to be a lot of problems down the line?
Yes, it would be helpful because it's not only taxes, violations, could be lead paint violations. There could be toxic spill on the property, and you're just putting yourself in the chain of title for all of that. Some individuals protect themselves by setting up corporations. A surprising number of people take it in their own names. Had a couple from Idaho drive in last week who purchased a property on the internet and through a quitclaim deed. And just what were you thinking? But unless we can get on those late night shows and try to counter some of that, and it's a worthy thing to try to explain to people how to protect themselves, and they do need to protect themselves because I'm sitting there, you know, just waiting. If the city files a case and they prove their case, you're going to be fined. And my job is to uphold the standards, whether you're an elderly couple who has a property that you live in, or you're a corporation or an individual lives in some other country, you have certain responsibilities. Now, the dynamics of ownership are different, and so I can weigh those things in, but I'm surprised by all the people that make bad choices in purchasing property on the internet. And some in person.
Well, thanks to each of you for sharing your best practices in your respective communities. You have given us all, those of us in the room and those who are joining us via a webcast, all some food for thought and some things that we can go back into our communities to implement. Please help me in thanking the panelists.